Welcome to the Writer's Block podcast. I'm writer Polly Roberts, and every episode I will be in conversation with another Cornwall-based writer, discussing process, why we write, and the part Cornwall plays in our work. I hope you find some wisdom and inspiration in what you hear. The Writer's Block is the creative writing centre for Cornwall. With innovation and creativity at our heart, we offer both a place to write and a unique approach to developing confidence and skills in writing for everyone. In this episode, I will be speaking with Misri Day, an international theatre practitioner. Misri is senior lecturer at Falmouth University in theatre and acting. Her latest solo show, Family Tree, explores themes of identity, melding the personal and the political. We will be discussing these, along with her unique process and approach to working across disciplines. I hope you enjoy what you hear.
Hi, Misri, and welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you along.
Thanks, Polly. It's good to be here.
It's really strange. We've just discovered the fact that we're both in the same village. So potentially could actually be making the most of being able to sit in a room together. But it's wonderful to me. I mean, we were just saying this thing of knowing creatives that are nearby. And I wonder, is being part of the creative community particularly important to you in your work?
It is. I mean, it's a complex one, isn't it? Because I don't think there's a creative community. I think in Cornwall, as all over, I think there are lots of different kinds of creative communities. Mm. I think that geographically, because we're all in a relatively small area, that kind of casual intersection between people is really enjoyable and does build up a kind of matrix of feeling like you're part of a bigger thing. And it's important that in terms of, you know, some of the subject matter of what I do and engaging with ideas around community. Community is not a word I necessarily use, but group, you know, belonging, those are all kind of quite live, important terms and practices at the moment. And so it's a good question to start with, really. I mean, I've been here 12 years and I have done various projects, creative projects, and through those you get to know people, don't you? And those have spanned across, I would say, live theatre, some dance, some community work, and village interactions, you know, where you meet people and get involved in village local events. And we have the brilliant Tolman Centre here in Constantine. So engaging with the kind of group of volunteers that curate that. A long answer, I suppose.
The word that kind of jumps to me is intersectionality. I really like this sense that I'm getting that for you, it's not necessarily there is this community and that community, that actually there's a bit of an interest in you about where those boundaries blur and working with people across many forms. And it's something that fascinates me about your work is, I mean, I wonder if you could actually describe to me, how do you describe yourself as a practitioner and what do you describe as the work you do? Because you seem to do a bit of everything.
Yeah, I mean, I describe myself as a theatre practitioner. It depends who you're talking to, doesn't it?
Yes.
You know, and that's not kind of lying, but I think that it's also to do with what they will understand and relate to. Mm-hmm. So you connect with people. So I call myself a theatre practitioner. I call myself an actor, a performer, a deviser, a writer for theatre, an activist, political activist, cultural activist. I think of Bryony Kimmings, who's a solo performer in London, where she calls herself a theatre slag. and it's kind of, you know, the different terms that suit but work in terms of what other people are doing and what they'll understand, really. So I'm all of those things.
Yeah, wow. And does that work for you, having a multitude of names and titles and parts and roles that for yourself? I mean, I'm thinking, I was talking just this morning with someone about us wearing many heads and that typical thing of saying, you know, I am a mother, I am a daughter, I am a sister, I am me, I am a friend. And yet there's sometimes that sense of confusion of, well, can I just be me, the whole person. So I wonder, how is it for you changing who you describe yourself even as, depending on who you're talking to?
I think it's very familiar. And I think you're right that at times it's beneficial and at times it can be problematic. Beneficial because you can find work on a very practical level, you know, and you can also help people with their work and get involved in different projects. And also because I was thinking about what richness is to me, and richness to me is a kind of variety of experiences. I find that to be kind of one definition. And so it's beneficial. It can be really great. And it can be problematic as well, because you can end up not necessarily finishing projects as well as you'd like to, or giving as much time to things as you'd like to. But I think it's a reality of most artists and practitioners today that we have to be, you know, polymaths. We've got to. If anybody's ever written an Arts Council application, or you know that you've got to be an administrator and a writer and not go crazy. So you know, and it's the work. I mean, of course, I'm a lecturer as well at Falmouth University, and it's what we say to students as well, that you know, being flexible, being you know, there's different words for it, the portfolio career type thing. But also, so I can also talk about that in terms of cultural background, because I'm also mixed cultural heritage.
Yeah,
I'm very used to and resilient to switching. Code switching is one term for it. Changing's not the right word, but sourcing aspects of my cultural heritage and background, which are varied.
Yeah.
So from the age of naught, I was used to that. You know, I had two or three different languages in the house.
Wow.
So that's given me, and it gives mixed heritage people practice and resilience in doing that. And it's something that I think is really important to promote and trumpet from the rooftops, which is, you know, why aren't we more present in these places now, if ever? Resilience, you know, flexibility, adaptability is needed as core skills. And we mixed heritage people practice that daily.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So there's that. And then there's also solo practice, which I've done quite a lot of solo performance making. And my research in the last 10 years, I'd say, is into solo performance. And that is very much about multiple skills, multitasking, being a writer, a performer, a deviser, a designer, a sound person.
Yes.
Sometimes. Sometimes you also collaborate with people and work with their brilliant skills. So it doesn't mean that you have to necessarily be brilliant at all of that, but you certainly have to have your head into that kind of orchestration. So with all of those things, I think it comes with my terrain and territory and identity.
Yeah, it's so fascinating for me to kind of, I feel like that's a really positive way of embracing it and looking at it, and then actually how it can become an empowered thing. Because I guess I might have the inclination to think, sometimes I can think as a woman, let's say, like, oh, my flexibility can be something that I've been taught and I have to maintain, and it can be something that stops me from feeling like I'm empowering myself and doing what I want. But actually, at the same time, there is a truth to this fact of we are not one thing. And I think it can be quite a modern day concept, this idea of you are, well, a writer or a pub owner or a landlord or whatever it is. And just thinking, actually, hang on a second, that's totally unrealistic, this idea that we can sit into one role. So to really embrace that and use that in your work. And I was really interested in that. So, for instance, in your latest solo piece, Family Tree, that it's a solo piece, and yet you also worked with so many people, a choreographer, musicians, and I think many people to bring that together. So that interest from you, I was really curious about, of the bit of wanting to work alone and have that control, but also actually that openness to wanting to work with others as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an obsession of mine, and I've rotated around the whole theme of mixedness and mixed identity for the last, I suppose my first piece was Bed, a radio performance in 2003, which was funded by Decibel, which was then the Arts Council's kind of equalities kind of unit trying to promote, you know, at the time, people of colour, although that wasn't the term used, but their work. So that was the first piece I wrote. And since that's 2003, so that's 19 years ago, isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether other artists say this, some that I've read do, you know, you kind of are always working around certain themes, but in different ways. So I'd say that in terms of vision, holding an idea and an obsession and pursuit and curious kind of exploration of something, that's what solo work gives me, the ability to do that. At the same time, I always say that solo doesn't mean having to be alone, and absolutely it's collaborative, and you know, why do it all on your own? For a start I can't and yeah. I wouldn't want to, and it's lonely and it's boring being just on your own. I started doing it kind of on a very pragmatic level, to be honest. I didn't always do solo work. I came from group devised work in my training and my professional work in London, right, and in Amsterdam. So, you know, and toured with devised theatre companies. But it was a very practical decision, economic and practical, Polly, which is around having a full-time lecturing job and trying to continue with a creative practice at Dartington. So that's where it started. So I had access to studio space and I had me. So I could do it, you know, in a way. Rehearsing didn't involve organising anybody else apart from myself. I say, I've made a series of cartoons. One of the things is solo, you're never late for rehearsal. You know, so it was quite a pragmatic choice. Having said that, and I've kind of gone down that, you know what it's like, you start the ball rolling and now I've become Ms. Solo, you know.
Yes.
And I love it. And I also absolutely, this last project has been a joy to collaborate with other people, an absolute joy. I'd say it's the first properly funded project I've done in a long time.
Right.
And so, as you said, working with Sarah Levinsky, the dramaturg, absolutely essential. Aga, also Blonska, director, but called it the choreographer. And it's been, because it was a research and development phase, their inputs, with the dramaturg, Sarah, it was the biggest input, if you like, to get the piece of work on. Right. But the other inputs were smaller offerings, and we worked together, and then I would carry on working on my own.
But can you tell us a bit, because I'm sure our listeners, some of them will know about it and some of them won't, tell us a little bit about that project.
Yeah, thanks. So Family Tree is an exploration of taking my actual family tree, which, as I said, I come from multiple heritage backgrounds. So my grandparents and great-grandparents come from Bengal in India and the north of Italy. And it's exploring four generations across three continents, some of the stories of those people. However, it's really not about that in a bigger sense. I wasn't wanting to do a piece which is about my family. Really, it was looking at that as a structure and architecture around which we can explore ideas of borders, boundaries, mixedness, crossing borders, belonging, immigration, migration, annoying family members, elbows round a table, you know, secrets, lies that all families have. So it was really trying to take that as a structure to explore some of those questions. And it, I guess the kind of question in it was how I could use my one person's family history and perspective on a history, because of course it's one, my perspective. How I could do that in order to connect to wider social issues around, as I said, migration, immigration, borders. So that's the kind of theme. As you said, it's multidisciplinary. I use direct address to an audience. I speak directly to the audience. I use music. I sing and I use a loop pedal a lot to create layered sound live in the performance, which was quite nerve-wracking because I hadn't done that actually. I mean, I'd sung in performance and I'd used guitar and I'd done that kind of. I have done a lot of singing in performance, but I hadn't used the loop pedal, so that was that was interesting to operate that live. And it was important for people to see me doing that layering. That was part of it. And then I use something which is my favorite piece of low kind of old technology at the moment, called a visualizer.
Wow.
Which is, and I don't know how old you are, Polly, but anyway, there used to be a thing called an overhead projector, OHP.
Yes.
Yeah. Which people might know from school. You know, it was often used in school or at university, and you put transparencies on it and draw on it and stuff. So it's a bit like that, but it has a camera at the top. So you can, it's like a video camera at the top. So you can have, you know, your hand or a book or objects are three-dimensional on it as well as photographs. So it,
wow.
Yeah, and it's got functions on it as well. I just had a really great few sessions exploring the functionality of it. So it can zoom in and it can zoom out. And for me, originally I got the work is based really around a series of 10 to 12 photographs from the past, from my family, from the present. And I initially had those on a PowerPoint, you know, just slides on the wall. Yeah. But it was much too flat and much too distant and much too other. And it wasn't right. And then I used this visualizer and you see my hands and you see me moving these photos. And then there's the possibility to zoom into a detail of the photograph where you really and of course it's done through a projector, so they're enormous in the space on the back wall. They're much bigger than me,
yeah,
which also felt really important. You know, it's always so tempting and understandable to think that a solo piece of work is about the person and that they are the center,
yeah,
and you do need to be that, you need to hold that center, but this wasn't, I don't want it to be about that. I mean, it isn't about that. It's about everything else as well. So this huge image and with my hands changing the photos and so it's using image like that. And it's also using some video archive video footage. My father was in a film. So I had some of that playing and movement. My training was in dance as well. And so I use movement and physical theatre. So yeah, total theatre it's known as, might be familiar to people, just using, and again that links to my heritage. You know, one of the things that I remember seeing when I was about 18 was a Kathakali performance where I was like, that's me. Oh right. And of course in other forms of performance like Kathakali, or you know, going using dance, using sound, using speaking, using acting is absolutely the kind of norm. So yes. Again, it was about, you know, 7 or 8 years ago when I was like, oh, am I just jack of all trades? Am I using too many things? And then it was like, no, of course, it's absolutely fine. You know, you use what the work seems to suggest it wants, really.
Yes, yeah.
So that's it. So there's a series, you know, that's the piece of work. And it's a comedy. Rather, it's comic. There's comic. I kind of, you know, the themes of migration, immigration, loss, borders, terrible borders.
Yeah.
This piece of work I was performing when Russia had just invaded Ukraine.
Gosh, what timing.
Yeah. And I sing Bella Ciao. That's the other thing that's important to say. There is a song, Bella Ciao, which I know from my family. My mother sang it to me. And I have taught it to students. And then my brother, who's a guitarist, who did the composition for this. So I collaborated with my brother. He was the composer. He was in a punk band called the Dog-Faced Hermans in Scotland. And they did a punk version of Bella Ciao. And I've always loved that version. He's the cool elder brother who does punk stuff, you know. And so the piece is also, I'm exploring how to use that one piece of music throughout the whole piece. And he created a whole bunch of tracks which were taking that piece of music, the Dog-Faced Hermans track, apart. So we use different aspects, you know, trumpet and guitar and drums in the work. We kind of take it apart. And So, you know, that's those are some of the kind of elements of the work. It's a research and development phase. So I did perform it as a whole piece at in Bristol at the Wardrobe Theatre, and I did a section of it in Exeter at the Phoenix there, and I did another whole piece here in Amata at the Performance Centre in Penryn. And the next phase is to go back to the rehearsal room and take all the feedback from the audience, because we had Q&As at the end.
Right.
And those were really, really informative. The audience, you know, the audience, of course, you're making a piece of work for an audience. So their feedback and comments are going to be woven back into what I redevelop with the idea, hopefully, anyone listening, that we're going to book a tour. We're going to book a tour for summer, autumn next year.
Oh, incredible.
And in fact, we have our first, we're already going to be performing at the Wonderful Impossible Theatre Falmouth International Arts Festival that just started here Amazing. In Cornwall this year, the pilot. Gabby and I have been talking about booking that work for then. So we've got our first booking, so...
Amazing.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that being part of the growth of the project as well, because as I hear you talking about it, I'm that word growth just kept on coming to me, and this idea of stories within stories within stories, and not stopping just at the photograph and what the actual story is, but that recognition of, well, this is actually just my story, but when I shift it around a little bit, there's so much more to it, and then there's a biggest, and then realizing that thing of, if I experiment with different forms, then other stories can start to come out and tell themselves that too, because different voices create different tellings. And that's so much of what we actually encourage and do at the Writer's Block. So it's interesting kind of hearing that as your process, but then also this element of then having the audience partake in the next step and how that story then progresses again. And I wonder, did you have, or do you have kind of hopes in a more political sense of what this piece could do?
I was looking at, you know, how could I connect with people of colour and with white people in the same piece of work? Can I?
Mm.
Can I? And if so, how? It's always that question, isn't it? I would say that my political aim in this work, which is absolutely right, I was doing more direct political activism a couple of years ago, literally in terms of party politics. And I needed to step back for a while, and also to return to art making, which is my form of cultural politics, if you like. And so I would say, yes, there is a political aim. My political aim in this is to connect to people of different ethnicities, white people, black people, brown people, and to, one, to connect with them, and two, to potentially, well, what do we all want to do with our arts practice? I think move them a little bit in some way.
Mm.
You know, a small moment of something which might affect their lives. That would be my ideal. And then I can answer that more harshly in some ways. I had a really interesting feedback from Kirsty Cotton, who's at the Hall for Cornwall, who's been great and been involved in the project with some production support. And she was saying to me, and I don't think she'd mind me saying this, I think she was saying to me, come on, Mystery, you can give us a harder time, you know? And it was, yeah, absolutely. I spend lots of time furious, but it's that delicate balance, which is that I'm not writing a journal article in a paper. Mm. I'm not preaching at people. I find that kind of agitprop, in-your-face political theatre exhilarating in some ways, but... can be, you can have elements of it. So it's always a juggling. But yeah, the political side, absolutely. My fundamental thing is, I think borders are ridiculous. I think that we all have these arbitrary geographical lines drawn up that we think mean something, and they don't. They are often, in India, for example, drawn up by some colonial person sitting in an office with a green pen. I think there's one called the Green Line. I was just reading recently, I can't remember which border, it might even be partition in the border between Pakistan and India, the green line. I don't know. Don't quote that. I might be wrong, yeah. Listeners. So, you know, I know there's a line in India which is called the green line, and it was green because of his pen was green.
Wow.
That is how arbitrary and detailed one needs to get about these borders that we then glorify as real, and the bloodshed and anguish. So, yes, if I have a kind of central, at the moment, a central political motivation, it is to really question everybody's and my own notions of borders.
And I love that word you use alongside it, of borders are ridiculous, and then there being this comedy element to what could be a very serious performance,
yeah,
and sort of playing on that ridiculousness and using that as a way to connect. I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, and also it's just fun. I mean, yes, you know, let's face it, the amount of grimness that we have around us at the moment, you know, who's going to want to come and see a piece of work which is going to make them feel just so terrible again? And, you know, it's fine to feel terrible sometimes. It's very important to feel uncomfortable and all of the things that we do. And you have to take care of yourself if you're an activist, and people in this world who care have to take care of themselves. So, yeah, humor is an absolute way to connect. I think it's the way that I find is one of the most powerful ways. It's quite quick. And in that moment where somebody smiles, even inside, there is a connection. And I think from that, there is a potential, let's not get too lyrical about it, but I think there is a potential relaxing or opening, which is an invitation to me. And I just jump in there.
Yes. Go for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder, because it's interesting what you were saying about how a few years ago you'd kind of gone more directly into that political. I find it really interesting then that movement back towards arts. Because I know you were part of Cornwall Voices of Colour. I don't know if you still are, and that you've done bits with Black Voices Cornwall, I think.
Yeah.
And you organised the Kimberley Park Kneel for George Floyd. So, and I think you've mentioned the kind of more party politics that you were actually at one point going towards being a local councillor. So that there really was this, or is this element of you, but it sounds like that's very central. And yet there is this kind of movement towards a more comfort maybe in, or belief, is it, in doing that through art, from that experience of going more directly at it?
Yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky. Again, we come back to that conversation when you're kind of jack of all trades. I think it was amazing to me. I mean, it was all of these things are of the moment, aren't they? What's happening in our world at the moment, and how do we as people respond to it in ways that might be useful? You know, so it just seemed to me at that time, and it does seem a bit bonkers in a way, but it's not really. It's like, you know, there's actually quite a few people who are theatre people, like Augusto Boal, who moved his whole theatre company into the Brazilian parliament. You know, he became an MP and he brought his theatre company in, and they were very well tooled up to go onto the streets, find out the issues and start creating policy, you know, on a simple level. So,
yeah,
it isn't so, you know, there are lots and lots of kind of meeting points, but I would say that a moment happened where Jeremy Corbyn, and I wasn't obsessed by him or, you know, a Corbynite, if you like, in that kind of way, but actually I was saying this to somebody yesterday, people who work with equality, I just, you know, I can support quite easily. It's like everybody has problems and problematics and what have you, but on a fundamental level, straightforward. There was a moment there, wasn't there, which seemed to be potentially where, you know, and I'll unashamedly say I'm a Labour supporter, where we could have a Labour government, and it presented itself. And literally at the Tolman Centre here, we had a hustings where the different candidates were going to speak, and I went along. I knew the Tolman as a theatre and a community space, but I didn't think of it as a political space. And there was a hustings. I went along and I just thought, okay, we need to just get out there and do it in that way. Perhaps I can help. And it went on from there, and it did snowball, actually. I mean, it quite rapidly. you know, I ended up being really, really involved. And you do. The thing is, you know, it's a lot of it is voluntary. And there's a real equalities problem with that.
Yes.
So it can be, you know, it can exclude a lot of people as well. And I could at the time give huge amounts of my time because I juggled everything madly to do that. But, you know, it's not sustainable for a long period of time. Anyway, that's an issue that I think needs to be addressed. But what you were asking me was about.
Well, I think it's really interesting, actually. You kind of just made me think. So I was asking you about that movement from that seriousness into, and actually what it was just making me think hearing you speak was, again, that thing of using the word ridiculous against borders. And what I just heard or saw as you were speaking was you just not necessarily seeing those barriers or borders that others might see and just stepping over, going, do you know what? I see a need and why can't I step in? Look, there's this thing. I'm going to go and talk about this. Look, there's this opportunity. And it kind of made me laugh internally because suddenly I was thinking, why not? Why not move from doing X to Y? Because actually, it all makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And I mean, there are lots and lots of connections there, aren't there? There's performance. You know, you have to perform as a politician all the time. Mm. There's networking and talking to people and doing all of that. You've got to be physically really robust and resilient and get out on the streets and get drenched in rain and knock on doors and talk to people and improvise a lot. I like meeting new people. I enjoy talking to people. You've got to be fairly opinionated and strong-minded in some ways and resilient, like theatre people and creatives are. So it's just, of course, it also has a whole huge other side, which you know, is the kind of knowledge bank and everything. But I was also a researcher, so that, you know, you bring skills from that. You can bring skills from other areas and they cross over. And as I said, there was a need, it seems. And, you know, for example, I was the BAME, Black and Minority Ethnic Officer, for our local constitution, you know, our local party here, constituency party, because there wasn't anybody else doing that role, so there was a lack, and it just went from there. And
and you were saying earlier about teaching some of this multidisciplinary element or having to wear multiple hats to your students at Falmouth, and before we started the podcast you were sort of saying about how now there's going to be a recording element to the course, and it sounds as though you were sharing this experience of why not, and of also the necessity of what you're saying there about stepping into that role because it was needed. So actually seeing the value in having lots and lots of different skills and being able to step up where, not just where you can, but where it's also necessary to. And do you enjoy sharing that with students and with young people and in this current world?
Oh, completely. I mean, I'll just kind of clarify. There are two degrees at Falmouth. There's acting and theatre, and I work across both. And a lot of the core staff do. When you're a lecturer in university in theatre, you if you're a full-time member, part of the job is to be a generalist in some ways, you know. There are a number of modules that need teaching and there are a number of staff there, and you can't just work in the area you want to. And, you know, you have reached a level of in your career, in your profession, where you can get more information and therefore teach what needs to be taught. So there is an element of that which all the staff do. It's not just peculiar to me. And the recorded side of it has been going in working in recorded media alongside the acting degree the whole time. It's just I haven't taught on that module before. But in my practice, I am a singer. I've done a lot of voice work. I've done recording. I've done for, you know, music, for radio, for I've done quite a lot of that. And so it's interesting as well to go and do that. You know, as a teacher, you need to change things around. You know, not just get into one groove. That doesn't work. After a while, it gets stale. And So I'm excited to work on the project. And yeah, you know, it's sometimes a bit nerve-wracking, isn't it, to start doing something new again? And that's exactly what 18, 19, 20-year-olds are doing all the time. We're asking them to do that. We're asking them to be vulnerable, to try things. I love the fact that the word expert, its root is experere, which is to try.
Amazing.
Yeah, exactly. I was so excited when I heard that, when I found that out. I was like, yeah, that makes sense. And that's exactly what we're asking students to do. So, of course, we need to be doing that as well. It's really good to put yourself back into that quite, you know, new place. So, yeah, of course. And working with university students, well, I mean, I've been doing it now for... since my first job was in 99, so 22 years, and it's always changing, always challenging. And I get to kind of have lots and lots of kind of interactions with young people around stuff I love, so I am very lucky on that.
Yeah, and that changeability, it fits with everything else we've been talking about too. So in a way, I can really see that fitting and that appeal. And I know as a creative for myself, I like change too. And I am adaptable, and I see stories where they lie in places that maybe aren't obvious that they would have stories in, and I like meeting new people and getting inspiration from various things. So I can see that actually that environment is really suitable to that. And I was wondering, having kind of realized how many different elements there are to you and your work and your practice and your education and everything, is there a norm when you're creating a piece of where you start in terms of with dance or with theatre or with writing?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. There isn't a norm, but I would say that over the years I've seen some patterns. So I have a collaborator I work with called Chris Quickmay, who's a visual artist and a painter, and we met at Dartington. He used to run the arts department there, and we have a kind of practice that we do together, and it's in his book. He's got a book on it, on dance, a couple of books. One, it's called Body Space Image, and they're beautiful books, and on improvisation, that's what he's worked on. And we kind of came back to this exercise often, which is physical improvising, and one person that you work in a two, one person's watching, one person's doing. In his version of it, you don't start with anything. You just start physically improvising. And by that, I mean, for people who, that might sound like a weird word, it means just moving how you want to, you know, how you're feeling in the moment in reaction to your environment and your own impulses. And one person watches. And then after a period of, say, 10 minutes, you both write. And you don't write like trying to describe what's happened. You're not documenting in that sense. You're just writing from the moment, and some of the images that you've just seen, witnessed or done will come into your writing, but you're not having to do that. And it's a difficult one to kind of quite explain. It's much easier to just do it. But I always work with students and with this exercise, because I work with it, so I work with them, and I really say to them, you don't have to describe, I walked left and moved and jumped onto the floor, you know, it's not that. It's things might be suggested, associations might come, you know, I might have looked like a duck and you go writing about a duck, and, you know, and then you swap, you know, and the other person moves and you write, and then you share the writing. And my variation is that I can take this kind of piece that this theme or idea, or, you know, family tree started. I've got to go back in time now, because it actually started, it's COVID, you know, COVID's like created this hiatus. Started as Leave to Remain was the kind of working title. And so I suppose, as I said to you, I've always worked with themes of cultural heritage, and I wanted to make a piece of work. I knew I wanted to make a piece of work. I knew I could make a solo. And I knew that I was, you know, you're just open to what's going on around you, as I think artists are. I think that's our job in some ways, is to kind of have that porosity to the world. And what was coming in for me at that time was this term, leave to remain. And I was actually thinking of it as, isn't that weird? Leave to remain. I was thinking of it on a literal way, thinking you've got to go in order to stay. You've got to, and I really liked that kind of, I was, you know, being quite, I know that it, you know, of course it's a term of for people to have to get the right to stay in a country, you know, it's a kind of legal term, but I was thinking of that word literally and it just stayed with me. So I kind of had that image in my head. So anyway, that's the, and I was exploring that, and then actually alongside that family tree kind of evolved. So that tends to happen in terms of my own practice. Again, yeah. I tend to have kind of two pieces seem to be making themselves as I go along.
Amazing.
But this exercise, you know, I would bring to it, I usually bring to it a kind of theme, or so whether it was leave to remain or family tree, you know, I might bring that, I might just have that in my head, or, you know, and then I move from it. And we did the thing. And then also with me, because I'm more of a performer and actor, I get us to speak what we've written to each other aloud. So it's kind of spoken text, you know, it's performed in a way. And just doing that's such a powerful exercise. And I would say that I use that as a starting point in my work a lot. The other thing to say about that, I suppose, is that no, I don't really have one way of starting. I will definitely work from my body. I naturally go into a space. I don't sit down at a computer. That's not how I would start working. I need to be on my feet, moving. I suppose with, you know, increasingly I find it very helpful to have some objects or things, companions with me. So again, it doesn't all come from inside my head, but then I move between, just depending on
what it calls for.
It's
really interesting. And I mean, you're just reminding me as well of that I think you said at some point the difficulty to explain, and I know I've tried explaining in the past to someone how dancing feels like telling stories to me, and that I don't know what the story is until I start dancing, and then I discover that I'm telling the story with my body. And I love what you were saying about the reading aloud part. I use that a lot in my workshops, that encouraging people to read their work aloud that they've worked on in response to prompts, because of that idea that it brings something else when you then hear it aloud. There's a whole other layer to it. But I love that exercise you've described, and I want to now go and meet you and do it.
Oh, please come, because I'll be doing it. I'll be doing it literally the week after next.
Oh, wow.
So
amazing.
You should come in. I mean, there, you know, go. I think I also think it's really great to have practitioners and people come into the studio spaces. It, you know, our spaces should be like that, really, a bit open. But I think it is such a powerful exercise, and it is in... If anyone's interested, it's in Chris's second book. It's Chris Crickmay. You probably have a thing where you can
put a link in.
But it's called Widening the Field, the book, and I think it's in there, Conversations or something. It is, and it has stayed with me. You know, it's like that thing about. Of course, I want to ask you about your practice, but I'm not really meant to do that here, am I?
We'll do that later.
Yeah.
Well. It's been so wonderful to talk to you, Misri, and I'll let you go now. But before I do, and maybe this one's going to be a really difficult one for you to answer considering everything we've chatted about, but we normally end on asking what would your ideal creative day look like? And I mean, maybe yours is just completely based in this moment. What would it be today if you were to have your perfect creative day unfold now?
If I was to have my perfect creative day unfold now, what a great question. What a great question. My perfect creative day unfold now. I'm going to be very literal with that. Well, I would wake up at about 5:30. I would look out my window because I'm so lucky that we've just gone up to the top of our house. And so my window overlooks a field. So I would see that. I would see outside immediately. My cat would arrive. It would involve very good Lavazza espresso coffee to start with. And then maybe some people on my street would all come and would all do some physical practice together on the rooftop. So moving, absolutely, before even brushing my teeth, really. moving, then probably a happy household. So my teenage son being in a good mood.
Yes.
And going, and he's a guitarist, so he maybe this is a Saturday. He wouldn't be awake at that point, actually, if it was a Saturday, so he wouldn't be awake. So let's say it is a Saturday. So we've done this lovely physical practice. We've eaten some really delicious food. And I would have, and I don't have this, but I would have a kind of big, fantastic workspace to be able to go in the village, I'd say. And we have got the Tolman Centre over there. I'm just looking at it now through my window. So actually, okay, let's you say the Tolman Centre, where I would meet with some collaborators and we would start working on something, whatever we were working on. And yeah, we'd probably have the whole day to do that. I fulfilled one of my dreams when I went and rehearsed on this piece, Family Tree, at the Tolman Centre, and I just walked two streets along. It was just brilliant. So we'd work there, and it would be warm. The heating would be on.
Yes,
there'd be a group of people working there. We'd be working on something, I think, I'd like to, well, maybe on a practical level, I would be developing this piece that I'm doing. So we'd be just, we'd have received Arts Council funding. That would be all fine. And I'd be paying people properly, which I do anyway. I have a real thing about that. I think that in Cornwall, it's a bit of an issue. And so everybody would be being paid properly, be there, and we'd work all day. And then I guess that's it, really. You know, we'd just have some lunch and hopefully we'd be able to maybe we'd be able to do something like this, like have a radio. I'd love to open up rehearsal spaces more. You know, I think it's really good if people communicate. So maybe in the middle of the day, you would come with your radio stuff and we'd do a bit of a kind of bloggy, how's it going?
Amazing.
That's it.
Perfect. And I love that mix of the creative elements actually and the practical elements that are so key to feeding creativity that you raise there. And and actually several of the guests on the podcast have said some of those similar things, the food and the money and the particularity of the space. And it's necessary in order for that creativity to be able to flow in that ideal way.
It's
been so lovely talking to you. Thank you so much for coming along. And yeah, hopefully see you around the village and hopefully get to see Family Tree and its completed reform when it comes out.
Yeah. Oh, Polly, thank you so much for giving me this time. It's been really, really lovely to talk to you.
You've been listening to the Writer's Block podcast. Find out more about the Writer's Block at thewritersblock.org.uk. Music and sound was by Jimmy Marshall from southwestsonic.com. Thank you for listening.